Watching the war unfold from Argentina provided a very unique perspective. I think I absorbed the information about what was happening differently because I was watching it from Argentina than I would have if I'd been back in Canada watching CNN. The reason for that is that Argentina is a country where the goals of the Iraq War have already been achieved. This is a country that was the International Monetary Fund's model student. And what that meant was embracing the economic formulas that they advanced. I'm going to come back to those later. But the bottom line meant that Argentina is a country that's been sold. That Zenon is in Patagonia, and Patagonia is where all the oil is, but all the oil's already been sold. Everything in this country has been sold. Even the street signs say brought to you by MasterCard. It's a hollowed out nation because they followed these recipes. And these connections are not lost on the Argentines. After we shot that scene, we went to an anti-war demonstration with the Zenon workers. And all of the placards and all of the chants made the connections between what Argentines call economic terror and the state terror that was launched on Iraq, that was unleashed on Iraq. And I think that we have a lot to learn from that, because here at home we often fail to make the connections between brutal economic policies, policies that create huge wealth for some at the expense, as we've heard tonight already, at the expense of jobs, at the expense of housing, at the expense of health care, and the military policies. There are a lot of people I've come to understand who actively don't want us to make these connections. And I realized that this was the eagerness with which the globalization movement was buried after September 11th. If you recall, there was this one headline that I loved in the National Post. I think it was on September 13th. The headline was, "Globalization is so yesterday." And the idea was that nobody was going to be interested in talking about the ravages of capitalism anymore. That's what we were told. That the world was now exclusively focused on an entirely new set of issues. War, terror, the clash of civilizations. We were told that these issues had nothing to do with the other issues. And that, in fact, everything we knew before September 11th no longer applied. Now, this was nonsense. But it is true, and I think it bears admitting, that many of us in the globalization movement were caught somewhat off guard by the military upsurge of the past 2 years. A lot of people instinctively made the transition from fighting the ravages of unleashed capitalism to anti-war activism, because we felt these connections instinctively. But many of us were not able at first to fully connect how warfare is used to enforce the very economic policies that we have been fighting against, although we can now see it quite clearly in Iraq. The anti-war movement, for its part, faced a similar problem. The mainstream anti-war movement in North America, not the entire anti-war movement, but sections of it, decided to focus almost exclusively on the atrocities of war. By that, I mean the violence, the bombs, the human rights abuses, the broken international laws, and now the military occupation. When explaining why these wars were erupting and the economic policies that underlined them, we rarely surpass pat answers like "it's about the oil." Some even argued that it was unnecessarily divisive to focus on these macroeconomic issues. And many activists were urged to stay on message. And that message was yes to peace, no to war, give peace a chance, and not to get into these areas where we might have disagreements. I believe that this failure to marry the economic analysis of the globalization movement and the anti-capitalist movements with the moral outcry of the anti-war movement has ended up hurting all of our activism. By failing to see the lengths to which capital will go to crack open new markets, The globalization movement seemed somewhat naive. But so did the anti-war movement, I would argue. Attempting to stop a war without directly confronting the economic agenda behind that war is like trying to stop a bomb after it's already been dropped. Peace never had a chance. Now, fortunately, these artificial barriers, these boxes, they're starting to break down, the borders between them. This is because, not through any wonderful activism of our own, it's the shamelessness of the Bush regime, the absolute shamelessness. Because now that this war has officially been declared over, the economic project behind the war has been dramatically unmasked. And now it is visible in all its shamelessness to see. Now, what is this economic program that I'm referring to? It's the same old, we know this program. I wished I could tell you it was something new and exciting and everything that you knew before was wrong, but unfortunately, it's the same model that is sometimes called globalization, but which Latin Americans call neoliberalism, or in Argentina it's just called El Modelo, because everybody knows what it is. In French it's called savage capitalism. But for the purposes of this lecture, if you'll bear with me, I'm going to call it MIC government. Because it is an economic franchise, and that's the point. There never was a movement against globalization and internationalism. It was a movement against the globalization of this economic franchise. We know its underlying purpose. It is making the world safe for multinational corporations, the wish list. And it has three key components. Most of you know them by heart. You've protested against them. You know them. But I'm just going to run through them really, really quick. This is the MIC government Happy Meal. Three ingredients. The first, mass downsizing of the public sector. Why mass downsizing? Well, a couple of wonderful side effects of mass downsizing, the kind of attacks that you're seeing on the public sector in Quebec right now under the Charest government. First of all, it means that there's less that corporations have to pay for with their taxes, so it's easier to argue for a tax break. Although it never seems to end up that way. They get the tax break, but it never ends up being cheaper. It also creates the condition when there's more unemployment and more uncertainty for a more flexible workforce that can be more easily manipulated by employers. But the other thing that starving the public sector does is it makes the public sector look bumbling, inefficient, useless, which in turn sets the ground for the second ingredient, which is mass privatization. Now, privatization is part of this recipe for the obvious reason. Privatizations give multinationals investment opportunities. Because this stage of so-called free trade is not really about moving more products around the globe, because actually there's a very finite and shrinking number of consumers. What it's about is taking things that aren't products, that aren't commodities, and turning them into commodities, like water, healthcare, education, seeds, intellectual property. That's what this stage of the market is about. The third ingredient is mass deregulation. Now, there's two broad categories that I'd separate this into. The first form of deregulation for creating, making the world safe for multinational corporations are the types of regulations that are designed to protect local industry, whether that is subsidies or restrictions on foreign ownerships or any of the ways that historically Quebec has protected its economy. The second form of deregulation is designed to remove all restrictions on the mobility of foreign capital, so that you can have your profits and not be told that you have to hire a certain number of people locally, or be told that you have to keep a certain percentage of your profits in the country where you made them. So that's the package. Downsizing, privatization, and deregulation to get rid of, one, the local competition, and to liberate capital. The results of all this corporate lubrication can be seen around the world. We see more and more people exiled to the margins of society, jobless, homeless, with fewer services to take care of them. And of course, we see less and less in the public sphere that is public. We see this enclosure, and the end game is what I was describing in Argentina, where absolutely everything has been sold and there's nothing left. In rich countries like ours, this project is introduced relatively slowly, although it feels like it's happening very quickly right now in Quebec. But if you compare that to poorer countries like Argentina, these reforms are very rapid. In fact, the phrase that was used by Carlos Menem, the president of Argentina in the 90s, for his cutbacks to healthcare and education and the mass downsizing of the state to ready for privatization, he called it surgery without anesthetic. In Chile, they called it shock treatment. In Russia, they called it shock therapy. We've all heard these quite brutal phrases. But that's nothing compared to what's going on in Iraq. Iraq is making all of that look like that looks like spa treatments. What's going on in Iraq is the use of shock and awe military force to enforce shock therapy. And reforms that took 3 decades to impose in Latin America have already been rammed through in 6 months. Now, why is this happening? Not because everything you know was wrong. It's happening for the same old reasons. It's happening because Iraq is a rich country. It has an embarrassment of natural resources and public services that have yet to be privatized. And this is, in fact, true of much of the Arab world. Oil wealth has kept Arab countries relatively outside the world trade system. Almost half of the Arab League nations are not part of the World Trade Organization. Even U.S. allies like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, their oil companies, along with much else of their economies, is still owned by the government. Now, the growth represented by these still untapped markets, these still closed markets, has become irresistibly tantalizing. It's like a big hunk of red meat dangling in front of hungry dogs. And capitalism does function that way. The hunger is not for the meat, it's for growth. Capitalism needs growth to survive, or else it spirals deeper and deeper into recession. And the reason why there's a desperate tinge to this stage in the evolution of the market is because growth is hard to come by these days. The market is in withdrawal. And it's not only that the stock market hasn't recovered before September 11th. It's also that the market's most reliable suppliers of growth have been holding out lately. Now, from the US and European perspectives, it used to be that if there was one thing that you could count on in international trade, it was the desperation of the poor. No matter how shoddy the deal you were peddling, you could always count on the desperation being stronger, that people would take a bad deal. That's starting to change. What we've seen, and I think it's quite remarkable. I mean, how many people in this room were in Quebec City for the Summit of the Americas? Nice. Well, if we think back to that, which was 2.5 years ago, I think that we had a fair perception that most of the dissent was outside the official process. Hugo Chavez was really the only one inside who even said anything at all negative about the model, El Modelo. And Latin America has been transformed since that happened. Across the continent, privatizations have been stopped in their tracks. Oil pipelines have been resisted. Gold and copper mines rejected by local communities because the ecological toll is simply too high. And then in the electoral realm, you have center-left candidates coming to power in Brazil and Ecuador, promising to govern in the interests of the poor. And then, of course, Argentina, where popular protests on December 19th and 20th, 2001, overthrew the neoliberal government of Fernando de la Rúa. And then there's still Hugo Chavez holding on despite his local elites, with the help of the U.S.'s most dogged attempts to push him out. And just last week, Bolivia. Massive political protests forced out the president, who had to fly to Miami. The uprising was sparked by an unpopular plan to sell the country's natural gas to the United States. And in fact, this wave of activism began with Bechtel's move to privatize the water of Cochabamba, and I'll come back to that. So where are their new markets going to come from? Where's the fresh meat? The Free Trade Area of the Americas is hugely unpopular across Latin America. That's why the next meeting is being held in Miami, because they decided they just couldn't have it in a Latin American country. And they actually are planning to have moved the secretariat to Miami, which is pretty incredible. The World Trade Organization talks in Cancun collapsed. More and more people are saying we have tried these policies. They made us poor. They hollowed out our collective wealth. And we don't want more of the same. So what this means in the context of what's going on in Iraq is that free trade light, which wrestles market access through coercion and bullying and the International Monetary Fund, that tries to crack open markets that way, isn't working. And that's why the Bush crew has stepped up. And they're not asking anymore. They're just taking. And they've moved from free trade light to free trade reloaded, which simply seizes assets on the battlefield of war. Everything you knew before isn't wrong. It's just worse. That's what the Iraq attack has been about. Bush has openly stated now that he wants a free trade zone in the Middle East within a decade. It's the next project after the Free Trade Area of the Americas. Iraq is the foothold, the wedge in the entire region, because it represents a massive market opportunity. It's that simple. Senator John McCain, who I don't quote very often, put it this way. He said, Iraq is a huge pot of honey, and it's attracting a lot of flies. The honey is not just the oil. The honey is also the water, the phones, the schools, the media, the trains, the planes, the jails. It's anything that can be turned into a commodity and sold for profit. That's the honey. The flies? Bechtel, Halliburton, MCI, ExxonMobil, Wack and Hut, Time Warner, Walmart, Boeing, News Corp, DynCorp, on and on. Now, before I go any further, and I do plan to go a lot further, the United States government must pay the Iraqi people compensation for this war. They must be given huge reparations for this attack. It's a moral duty, and it must be met. And that does not mean getting the Iraqi people to mortgage their own future oil revenues to pay compensation for bereaved families, which is what's happening right now. The vast majority of the money for Iraq is not going to the Iraqi people for anything like reparations, to spend how they decide. It's being parceled out, as you know, to U.S. firms selected by the Bush administration for something called reconstruction. Now, when you hear the phrase reconstruction, it sounds kind of benign. Now, what could be wrong with Americans going to Iraq, which they have just decimated, and rebuilding roads and rebuilding bridges and rebuilding hospitals and schools? Of course, that's what they should be doing. It sounds like the Peace Corps. Now, the problem is that these companies are not going to Iraq to rebuild it. They're going there to buy it. It's a shopping trip. As we talk, Iraq is being transformed into a giant shopping mall for US and a few British and maybe a few Canadian multinationals. It's the sale of the century. Bomb before you buy. Immediately after the war began, we started to hear about these huge contracts being handed out by USAID. And they were handed out in secret, without open bidding. And there was something strange about these contracts. It wasn't just that they were just going to Bush cronies. It was that contracts to rebuild schools and hospitals, for instance, that traditionally go to UNICEF, to the Red Cross, to nonprofit humanitarian agencies, were going to private U.S. HMOs and education companies that see education and healthcare as a for-profit industry, both at home and abroad. And we're already starting to see the first for-profit hospitals being built by for-profit firms in Iraq. And then there's Bechtel. Now, Bechtel has a contract that is now worth over $1 billion. And their job is to rebuild roads and rebuild bridges and so on. Now, this contract is controversial on many, many levels, and I'm only going to be able to scratch the surface here. One level is that many Iraqis, as you've heard, are angry that these jobs, which could be going to help rebuild Iraq's ravaged economy, are going to American companies. Now, this doesn't mean that they're actually going to Americans, because the Americans are actually outsourcing them, not to Iraqis, because they don't trust them, but they're bringing in people from India, and they're bringing in from other places in Southeast Asia. But they're going to American firms. Washington's explanation for this is absolutely simple and crass, which is basically, we bombed it, we bought it. It's our loot. Anger at Bechtel is also mounting because they're doing a really bad job of fulfilling this contract, which many Iraqi firms are saying they could do for a fraction of the price. Now, according to a recent article in The Economist, in 5 months, Bechtel managed to rebuild 1 mile of road. This is from The Economist. Of the 49 bridges that were destroyed by the bombing, they have started work on only three, and half of Baghdad's phone lines are still out. Now, we can't talk about reconstruction without talking about Halliburton. Now, as you all know, this is where Dick Cheney used to work as CEO. He actually still retains his stock options, and he's been paid more than $350,000 in deferred compensation since he has been vice president. But he nevertheless says that anybody who implies that the fact that he still has these stock options and is still getting paid is some kind of conflict of interest, he says that this is a quote, cheap shot. So allow me to be cheap. Halliburton has so far received almost $3 billion for its work in Iraq. And one of their contracts can go up to $7 billion. Did I say billion or million? Okay, sometimes I get those confused. It's important to understand how badly Halliburton needed this money, that this was no small favor that they got this contract. Because last year, it looked like Halliburton was going to go the way of Enron, if you'll recall. They were mired in accounting scandals and lawsuits. Last year, Halliburton posted a $500 million loss. And one of their subsidiaries, which is Kellogg Brown and Root, which is actually the subsidiary that is in Iraq, was planning to file Chapter 11 bankruptcy this fall. So how is Halliburton doing now? Well, very well, thank you. Their share price is up 77%, which is not bad at all for a market slump. And they went from a $500 million loss to a $26 million profit this quarter. So the bottom line is that this war has been wonderful for them. It's also that as CEO, Dick Cheney got Halliburton into all kinds of trouble, but as vice president, he has single-handedly saved their butt, which is no exaggeration. Let's look at what they're doing with the money. They're playing two key roles in Iraq, and both of them have to do with privatization. The first is that they're protecting Iraq's oil supply by putting out oil fires and repairing pipelines so that it eventually can be privatized. In practice, what this means is that U.S. taxpayers, as well as Iraqis in the form of future profits from their oil revenue, are subsidizing Halliburton to do this repair work so that the oil can then be privatized, and whoever the companies are that buy the oil, they don't have to shoulder that cost because it's been donated, corporate welfare. The second major role that Halliburton is playing in Iraq involves the rapid privatization of the U.S. Army. Now, George Bush has decided that the U.S. Army has one core competency in the language of management consultants. They have a core competency, and their core competency is combat, and that everything else can be outsourced. Basically, what Halliburton is the temp agency for the military. It has thousands of temp soldiers, 4,500 temp soldiers in Iraq, contract soldiers, and they do everything besides the core competency. They build the bases, they cook the food, they clean the latrines, they do the soldiers' laundry, they even cut their hair. And of course they do this all at cheaper rates than the soldiers, and the profits go back to Halliburton. They're the Army's outsourced wife. And there are a lot of profits going back to Halliburton because there's this very interesting clause in the contract, which is that Halliburton is guaranteed a 7% profit, which means that no matter how bad things get, they are guaranteed. This is the free market at work. They get their 7% profit no matter what. And according to two U.S. congressmen, and this just came out this week, Halliburton has been wildly overcharging for much of what they're doing, in addition to this profit. And in fact, they just discovered that Halliburton is charging $1.70 a gallon to bring oil to Iraq. And many other contractors... What? Oh, sorry, gas. And many other contractors are offering the same for $1 a gallon. So basically, they have a profit margin of 70%. Now, let's recap a little bit. The U.S. government, looking for new investment opportunities, new growth for its ailing firms, wages an unprovoked war with a partially privatized army, cleaning up afterwards using many of the same for-profit companies. And here's the kicker. When everything is cleaned up, America is going to sell Iraq off in pieces to those very same companies. Now, I wish I could tell you that they're going to sell off Iraq to the highest bidder, but what they're actually doing is they're selling Iraq off to the highest Bush-Cheney campaign donor. But what's already happening is that the so-called reconstruction of Iraq is segueing seamlessly into the privatization of Iraq. The real goal is now perfectly clear for anyone who cares to look. The U.S. government is not aiming simply to rebuild Iraq's roads, but to turn them into privately owned and operated highways. It aims not simply to reconstruct bombed out water systems, but to sell the water system to a company like Bechtel that will charge highly profitable rates. It aims not just to put out the oil fires and fix the pipelines, but of course to sell them entirely. Now, Bush and Rumsfeld and Paul Bremer, the US envoy in Iraq, now openly admit that they envision the reconstruction of Iraq as a remaking of the country into a free market economy, that this is part of their definition, which they're not hiding, of bringing democracy to Iraq. Just as we saw during the Summit of the Americas in Quebec City, this seamless conflation of the free market with democracy, although now it's at the barrel of a gun. Robert Fisk, the wonderful writer for the Independent in London, he put it well. He said that Paul Bremer's choice of clothing was very telling. You know, when Paul Bremer first arrived in Iraq, he wore a flak jacket. I don't know if you saw those first images. He wore a flak jacket. But it seems like some PR person told him that that wasn't sending the right message, which was that Iraq is open for business. So suddenly he changed and he started wearing a business suit. But as Robert Fisk points out, he wears a business suit with combat boots, which could be the uniform of the new economy. In August, Bremer wrote a memo containing instructions to the Iraqi Council. Now, it should be remembered that when Bremer gives instructions to the Iraqi Council, they're inclined to follow his instructions because he handpicked the Iraqi Council. And it's also worth remembering that Paul Bremer himself is not elected to anything. This is the man bringing democracy to Iraq. He's an appointee of George W. Bush, who in turn then appoints the Iraqi Council, who are supposedly making these decisions. And then, of course, if you want to count George Bush as an appointee, then you have like an appointee's bringing democracy to Iraq. So he wrote this memo in which he complained that Iraq's economy was too protectionist, and he said it was dominated by socialist economic dogma, and which is interesting because Saddam Hussein's a lot of things, but he's not a socialist. And he said that Iraq had to pry open most of its industries for foreign investment. This is a direct quote. And sure enough, a couple of weeks later, in September, 200 Iraqi state firms were put up for privatization. They're on the auction block. Many of them have already been sold. So this is what reconstruction is, now out in the open, the auctioning off of somebody else's country. Now, according to new laws introduced by Bremer, U.S. firms can own 100% of these auctioned off companies, of banks, of mines, of factories of all kinds. The only exception is oil, but as I said, there's a reason for that. Now, who's going to get these contracts? Well, the companies that are already there are in a pretty good position to bid for these contracts because, of course, they're already there. They already have all their people on the ground, so they can undercut anybody else. And there was actually just a story in the New York Times on Sunday, which the headline was, "Companies get few days to offer bids on Iraq work." This is relating to these privatization contracts. And in fact, many of these bids were 3 days long. So they had 3 full days to get the competitive free market going. So obviously, it's going to go to Bechtel. Bechtel is one of the most aggressive promoters of the privatization agenda on the world stage. As I said earlier, Bechtel was actually thrown out of Cochabamba, Bolivia, because after they privatized the water there, promising greater efficiency, promising lower rates, water rates went up by 50%. And more than that, they made it illegal to collect rainwater because they said it was unfair competition. So they were ousted. Because there were massive popular protests, and then they have turned around and are now suing the government of Bolivia for lost profits. So you can see it can get messy out there with democracies and foreign governments to deal with. So what they've done in Iraq is quite amazing. They've cut out the middleman. They don't have to deal with foreign governments. It's the U.S. government selling directly to U.S. firms, of course, selling somebody else's country. So, what is going on in Iraq was never about reconstruction. It was always about privatization, disguised as reconstruction, mass robbery, masquerading as reparations. The mask came off this week. Now, you may have heard about this international donors conference in Madrid where Bush has been trying to get other countries to help pay for Iraq's reconstruction. Now, the reason why more countries aren't just laughing, of course, is because it's not about reconstruction. It's about who's going to get a piece of the action. And this donors conference, as it was called, was actually a massive trade show. And the product for sale was Iraq. According to the Wall Street Journal, and I try to use these conservative sources because I know how unreliable I am, the Wall Street Journal called this the Iraq Gold Rush. And they reported that so many private companies wanted to come to this donors conference that they had to cap it at 322, among them McDonald's, Exxon, Delta, American Hospital Group. They're all very, very concerned with the reconstruction of Iraq. There's been a new company to help with this process, launched by George Bush's former campaign manager, the national campaign director for the Bush-Cheney 2000 campaign, has decided to go into the private sector. What a surprise. And he started a company called New Bridge Strategies. New Bridge Strategies positions itself as a kind of a broker or agent for U.S. firms that want to take advantage of what they call Iraq's unprecedented opportunities. And if they need some political connection. So they sell themselves as politically well-connected, which they are, because this guy was also Bush's right hand when he was governor. And the Washington Post quoted anonymously one of the partners in this firm getting all giddy about how exciting everything was. He said this, "Getting the rights to distribute Procter & Gamble products in Iraq can be a gold mine. One well-stocked 7-Eleven could knock out 30 Iraqi stores. A Walmart could take over the country. Note the language. Take over. Knock out. There it is. This is the economic project behind the war. A massive new market bombed into being. This is a new meaning to hostile takeover. Now, before Iraq can be turned into this free market mecca, sorry, I won't call it that, that's not fair. Before Iraq can truly roll out the red carpet for multinational corporations, there are a few things that need to happen. Now, I talked earlier about the McGovernment formula. It's not just privatization. There's two other components, downsizing and deregulation. And you can rest assured that Paul Bremer is taking care of those two. I'm going to talk first about downsizing. When Paul Bremer got to Iraq, in his first month in Iraq, he laid off 400,000 Iraqis without pensions or reemployment programs. He called these mass layoffs de-bathification, and explained that he had to do this to purge Saddam Hussein's flunkies from government. Now, of course, some of this is necessary, but Bremer's layoffs went far beyond anything that could be described as de-bathification. Low-level civil servants with absolutely no ties to the party whatsoever were just laid off, fired en masse. He launched, in the name of de-bathification, a full-scale attack on the public sector. He did it for the same reasons that the public sector is attacked here in Quebec: to create opportunities for privatization, which he's already done, to create a more flexible workforce willing to work for less, and of course to lower the tax burden, which he's also done. In fact, he's given such a big tax break that the corporate tax rate in Iraq used to be similar to that in Canada. The highest income bracket is 45%. It's now 15, thanks to Paul Bremer. That's a bigger tax break than even George Bush is handing out at home. So that brings us to the third area. That's deregulation. Now, Paul Bremer talks about bringing the free market to Iraq. And of course, this sounds like Iraqi businesses are going to have all kinds of wonderful opportunities that they didn't have before. Well, we know that this hasn't been true for the reconstruction contracts, where they've actually gone to U.S. firms and they haven't had a chance to even bid. But there are a whole bunch of other ways that Iraqi businesses are being driven out of business under the Bremer regime. When he arrived, obviously, the Iraqi economy was in shambles, and Iraqi industry was in very rough shape. They'd been pummeled by 13 years of sanctions, by two wars, and 2 months of looting. So if you were actually interested in bringing the free market to Iraq, you might have done a couple of things before forcing Iraqi companies to compete with multinationals. You might, for instance, get the lights back on, and you might get the phones back on. You might wait for the spare parts to arrive that had been looted from all of the factories. He didn't do any of that. What he did, with the phones still out and the lights still off, he just flung open the borders to multinationals. Overnight, Iraq's market was flooded with cheap electronics, with packaged food and clothes from across the border. And what happened was entirely predictable. What happened is that hundreds and hundreds of Iraqi firms just simply went bankrupt. Unemployment in Iraq right now is at 70%. Iraq is not being rebuilt. It's being erased. First by war, then sanctions, then war again, then looting, now by this absurdly unfair foreign competition, which never gave them a chance. Now, why would they do something like this? Well, if you were Walmart and 7-Eleven and you were thinking about knocking out and wiping out the local competition, wouldn't it be nice if the local competition had already been knocked out and wiped out before you even arrived? Which is exactly what's happened. He's been handing out other goodies too. I mentioned the tax break. The other thing he's done is he has announced that that foreign multinationals can take 100% of their profits out of the country. So they can own 100% of the Iraqi economy, and they can take 100% of the profits out. Now, from a foreign investor's perspective, this is a dream come true. This week's Economist called Iraq a capitalist dream. And they went on to say that this set of policies that I've described, this pure Mika government, is, quote, a wish list of international investors. In other words, everything that these companies ceaselessly lobby for at home, and get most of but not all of, has been handed to them on a silver platter in 6 months in Iraq. Now, even Bremer's hand-picked appointees are getting pissed off. This week, there was a quote from the interim trade minister, and this was his quote. He said, "We suffered through the economic theories of socialism, Marxism, and then cronyism. Now we face the prospect of free market fundamentalism." And he said, "The Iraqi people are sick and tired of being subjects of experiments. There's been enough shock to the system. We don't need this shock therapy in the economy." So he's using the exact same words that have been used everywhere, shock therapy. And Iraq has indeed become an experiment. It's become a sort of laboratory playground for the most neoconservative of Washington's ideologues to design their dream economy, which is fully privatized, downsized, deregulated, and open for business, to do in Iraq what they cannot do at home. Donald Rumsfeld was recently bragging about this, and he said, "Iraq will have some of the most enlightened and inviting tax and investment laws in the world." Sorry, in the free world. But there's this problem, right, which is that Iraq isn't free. It's under occupation. And that all of these decisions, so fundamental, as we know in Canada, to what kind of society we want, these are the questions that animate us. These are the questions that draw many of you to the streets. All of these decisions have been made by appointees, appointees, appointees. Once the Iraqis have their own government, it's going to be too late to decide that they don't want their economy owned by Halliburton and Bechtel, because that would mean breaking signed contracts, expropriating assets, changing the terms of agreement, and the U.S. won't stand for it. The troops will be back. In the name of democracy, the Iraqi people are being robbed of the most basic principle of democracy, which is the right of sovereign people to govern themselves. In other words, everything that we knew before isn't wrong. We can clearly see now that the attack in Iraq was waged to implement the very same policies that have been protested around the world, in Cancun, in Argentina, in Genoa, in Chiapas, in Seattle, in Quebec City in 2001. I think that the movement against the war turned an important corner today. There were demonstrations around the world calling for an end to the occupation of Iraq. Huge demonstrations in Washington and also here in Quebec, in Europe. But I think we need to be careful, once again, about the language we use around occupation, because we can't simply define occupation as military occupation. We can't simply ask for the withdrawal of the troops and handing over the power to the United Nations. Because what is abundantly clear is that the troops were just holding the door open. They were just valets. They were holding it open for Halliburton and Exxon, Walmart, Bechtel, and all the other flies. These are the real occupiers. If the troops pull out of Iraq after everything's already been sold and the contract's locked in, it will not be a victory for democracy. What it will be is a victory for a massive Bush cover-up, because this will create the appearance of democracy, which is what Bush wants for his election campaign, a facade of democracy for what is in fact a lutocracy, and that's exactly what he wants. So the call should not only be for an end to the military occupation of Iraq, this is crucial. It has to be for an end to the corporate occupation of Iraq as well. The call has to be for real democracy. We have this on our side. This is such a flagrant violation of the most basic principles of democracy. And Bush is here having to sell this war as a victory for democracy, because he can't sell it as a victory for security, because he hasn't been able to find any weapons of mass destruction. He hasn't been able to find any September 11th link. He hasn't been able to find Saddam Hussein or Osama bin Laden. We have to remember that his original plan was to sell this war as a victory for security. He can't do that, so now he has to sell it as a victory for democracy. He's on very weak ground. We can throw this back at him. We can throw his own rhetoric back on him, because what is going on in Iraq is not democracy. This war is on its local fronts to fight privatization, downsizing, and deregulation here in Canada, in Quebec. That also means fighting the security agenda of the Bush administration, which is continental integration. Now, these two agendas, fighting this economic plan and the security plan with Tent City and the Committee for Non-Status Algerians, these are the two fronts, and that's what this night has been about. Now, you don't need to tell me that here in Quebec, the effects of these policies has been to discard growing numbers of people, to let them freeze on the streets. Now, that's bad enough. What's worse is that when a new generation of activists dare to get furious, as we all should be, and to actually do something about it, to build temporary housing, to refuse to be quiet, to take over abandoned buildings, they are dealt with as criminals of the worst kind, attacked with riot police for putting up tents in a park. This is the way deep economic injustice is being dealt with across Canada. Rather than facing up to the scandalous number of people in this rich country who are being brutalized by poverty, our state is systematically trying to shut up the people who are screaming the loudest. Now, another way this economic agenda is playing out in Canada is the attacks on immigrants and refugees. And we all know that it's only going to get worse under Paul Martin. It's only going to get worse because Paul Martin has made it very clear, as he said, that his number one agenda as Prime Minister is to keep that border open with the U.S. For trade, not people, for trade. Now, the trade-off for all that trade is people. They're horse trading people. And he's going to cave in even more to these demands to harmonize our immigration and refugee policies. And that first, well, some of the first casualties of this harmonization process were Montreal area non-status Algerians. Now, in this case, unlike Ontario's ridiculous Project Thread, which is called now Project Threadbare, which was the scooping up of international students from Pakistan, there isn't even the pretext of a security concern. In Ontario, there was a pretext, which has since evaporated, but there is no pretext here. It's just that Algerians and many other refugees and immigrants are considered politically expendable, another class of disposable people. And once again, when activists, many of whom are in this room, dare to try to stop the deportations by occupying Denis Coderre's office, they were met with extreme violence. I find it shocking that police used electric prods, they used electric guns, taser guns, on demonstrators. Now, what can we do about this? Well, being here tonight is a great start, and I really want to thank you all for coming. Montreal's my hometown. That's why I'm a little bit nervous. There's people here who've known me since I was, like, born before. It's so tough. I'm regressing. But I want to challenge many of you who are not already involved to get more involved than just coming to a lecture, to stay informed, to follow the trials, to go to the trials, to dig deeper financially in one of the boxes that are making the rounds. Because the trials are coming up and the expenses are mounting. These trials and the time and expense that they cost the activists that you've heard from are exactly what Andrea said. They're a tax on dissent. They're a transfer of wealth, actually, from broke activists to the state. We have to respond as a community. And I hope that that little video that we saw could be some kind of an inspiration to how a community can support people who really are on the front lines. We need to lessen the financial burden of the defendants, that's what this night is about, so that they're free to do what they do best, which is to fight the policies behind the repression. Now, I don't know how many people are here tonight. 600? 600. So that means that maybe we raised 6,000. So I think we can get it up to 10. I do. We were hoping, actually, that you'd be older so that we could fleece you more. We tried to price it out of your market, you students. I think we can do it anyway. I really do. Most of all, the challenge that we face is the need to strengthen our movements. Because if we're going to fight this war on all of these fronts, we need strong, integrated movements that are capable of making clear connections between economic warfare and military warfare, between the war abroad and the war at home. Now, I'm here tonight because I feel very strongly that these violent and worrying attacks on civil liberties here in Canada are being met with equally worrying silence and apathy from many on the left. I'm talking about the academic community, I'm talking about progressive organizations, NGOs, artists, the legal community. Obviously, there's lots of exceptions, but there aren't nearly enough. Now, these activists that we're fundraising for tonight are on the front lines of the war against poverty and racism in Canada. Not everyone is going to be out there by their side. Not everybody is going to be sleeping at Tent City. Not everybody is going to be occupying the immigration minister's office. That's okay. God knows I've missed my share of actions. But when the people who are on the front lines are under attack, we as a community have a profound responsibility to go beyond our own comfort zones and defend them. If we're not on the front lines, we have to defend the people who are on the front lines. We have so much to fight for. Where will we be if we've lost the right to fight? Please defend the right to fight. Thanks.